animal, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Michael Hankson, blind since birth, a longtime best-selling author and acclaimed speaker. Hankson's most striking experience happened on 9/11 when he was working in the North Tower during the attack. Starting on the 78th floor, he led his guide dog, Roselle, and others in the building to safety. He wrote a book then chronicling his 9/11 experiences, incorporating other information and reflections, called Thunder Dog, The True Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and the Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero. The book immediately landed on the New York Times bestseller list, later rising to number one. He's published now a new book, co-authored with Kerry Wyatt Kent, called Live Like a Guide Dog, True Stories from a Blind Man and His Dogs about Being Brave, Overcoming Adversity, and Moving Forward in Faith. As the title suggests, the new book draws on Hingson's firsthand knowledge living with eight, count them, eight guide dogs over his lifetime, and what that vast array of experiences has taught him, such as how being afraid can serve as a virtue, strategy to prevail over misfortune, and how his faith, his deep belief in God, has proven pivotal. Here's what may constitute a fun fact. While attending the University of California at Irvine, Hingson was on the air and put in a stint as program director at KUCI, the student/community radio station, where some years later I launched Talking Animals. We'll discuss the new book and some of these other topics, probably including the radio history, since Michael now hosts a podcast, Unstoppable Mindset, when I speak with Michael Hankson in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Coming up later in today's program, we may hear an animal song and return to our roots, as it were, and surely an extended visit to the Comedy Corner. We'll see and kind of heed our whims later in the show here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Right now, though, let's talk guide dogs and what we can learn from them, or at least what our guest Michael Hankson has learned from eight of them, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Michael Hankson back to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, and KUCI has moved to new studios, and it's got like 2,700 square feet now, unlike what it used to be.
Wow. I remember when it was sort of just in like a sort of very cool but funky trailer.
Yeah, well, it's in bigger trailers now, and it's a huge place, comparatively speaking.
That's great. Yeah, one time I was in that area, and it was on a Wednesday, and I couldn't, for whatever reason, I just couldn't get a, didn't think it was right to have a sub that day. So I actually did Talking Animals from the KUCI studios with the help of our good friend Kevin there. So that was yeah, a nice thing. So anyway,
I got to go see Kevin and the station earlier this year. I was inducted in the Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society as an alumni member in June. So I got a chance to go down and visit for a while.
Oh, that's great. Well, congratulations, belatedly. That's terrific. Wow. Very well done. So I would guess this idea for a book like this, at least, probably doesn't come together fast, because essentially, as we will get into, as the title probably alludes to, the book really spans a lifetime. So walk me through the genesis of Live Like a Guide Dog.
So in 2020, when the pandemic started becoming noticeable and visible, I started thinking about what I was going to do, since I couldn't do what I would normally do, which is to travel and speak. Ever since September 11th, I've been a keynote speaker traveling and talking to corporations and organizations about lessons we should learn from the World Trade Center, trust and teamwork, moving from diversity to inclusion, because diversity typically doesn't include disabilities, and other subjects relevant to the corporate and just to the audience world at events. And so I was finding that I couldn't travel because of the pandemic. And I started thinking about other things to do. One thing was I started learning about podcasting, because I thought maybe that could be a way to generate income. But before I used it as an income revenue source, and it ended up not being one, I also started thinking about the fact that I've been talking for, at that time, 19 years about getting out of the World Trade Center and what I had done to escape, which was really preparing and allowing a mindset to occur in me that I didn't realize until much later, that said when the emergency happened, you know what to do and how to get out. Well, so I hadn't ever really talked about teaching people to deal with fear and to recognize that fear doesn't need to, as I would put it, blind you or overwhelm you or paralyze you, but rather you can use fear as a mechanism to keep you focused and not really become so overwhelmed that you can't make decisions. So it started out looking at doing a website, but quickly evolved to writing a book. And I met Carrie Wyatt Kent through Susie Florey, who was involved with me writing Thunderdog. And Carrie and I began writing this book, and our agent Steve Lobb found a publisher that would take the contract. And so we wrote Live Like a Guide Dog, True Stories from a Blind Man and His Dog. It's about moving forward, being brave, and overcoming adversity, and moving forward in faith. So anyway, the idea behind the book is I learned more from 8 guide dogs and my wife's service dog, Fantasia, about how to deal with life in general, and especially dealing with fear. For example, dogs don't do what if like we do. They don't think about, well, what if this had happened to me instead of that had happened to me? Roselle, after the World Trade Center terrorist attacks, when we got home, the first thing she did was to go off and grab her favorite tugbone, started playing tug-of-war with my retired guide dog, Linny, because it was over for her. There was nothing that threatened her. There was nothing that really caused her fear. And so the bottom line is that it was done. Dogs just don't do what if. We what if everything to death. And the problem with doing that is it creates so much fear in us that we worry about so many things over which we have no control. And the bottom line is we worry about all the things that we can't control and never focus as much as we should on the things that we can control. If we would just worry about what we have influence over and leave the rest alone, we would live and have much better lives, and we would have a calmer environment.
All right. Well, so what you said there kind of raises at least a handful of questions, either follow-up or just ones that I was going to maybe get to later. One is, first of all, in your experience, how unusual is it for someone to live with 8 guide dogs over their lifetime?
Probably pretty, well, mostly fairly unusual. Typically, guide dogs will work 6 to 8 years. My current guide dog, Alamo, has worked now for almost 7 years. It will be 7 years in February, and I expect him to go for quite a while yet. Guiding is a very stressful job. They take it extremely seriously. And what my job in part has to be in terms of me as the team leader of the team is I have to try to keep that stress as minimal as possible for the dog. And the more I can keep the stress out of what they have to do by how I react and how I behave, the longer they'll be able to work. My longest living guide dog was Holland, who worked for 13 and a half years.
Wow.
So it really is a question of how the dogs are treated. I know someone who got a whole bunch of dogs, like 12 dogs in like 20 years, because it was just a matter of how he dealt with the dog.
Yeah.
So for me, I believe that it's important to keep peace, to keep the stress out of the dog's environment, and to encourage and reinforce good behavior, and you do that in a positive way. So for me, having 8 guide dogs since 1964, so we're now dealing with basically 7.5 years per dog on average, and it's going to go up again with Alamo, I am sure. We lost a little bit out of the average with my 4th guide dog, Linny, who contracted glomerulonephritis from Lyme's disease, and so she was only able to work 3 years. And then my 6th guide dog, Merrill, just developed a fear of guiding after a year and a half. But outside those two, all the dogs have worked 10 years or more. So
yeah.
It's all about how we deal with the dog.
Yeah, well, that's one thing that really, not surprising, I guess, given the kind of nature of the book overall, comes through in the book and sort of is an extension of something we talked about, at least on one of our previous conversations, which is that a lot of people don't really quite understand what the role sometimes is between handler and dog. And I guess where that was really most pronounced was with the whole 9/11 saga. And the idea was that a lot of people sort of jumped to the conclusion that, oh my God, this is quite a story. This guy's dog let him down from the 78th floor. And you were quick to sort of correct me and others who sort of made that point, because the actual story is that you, the handler, led the dog and whoever else was kind of in the stairwell down, not the other way around.
Well, it's a little different even than that. The bottom line is that we work as a team, and more pet owners should recognize that they can develop a teaming relationship with their dog. And if they would really work with the dog properly, pet owners will find that they can establish a much more dual relationship between dog and people. In the case of the World Trade Center, and in the case of what a guide dog is supposed to do, the dog's job is to make sure that we walk safely. But it's my job to know where to go and how to get there. And I have to really deal with that. Technology makes that job easier than it used to be, because now I can use like Google Maps and other things on my smartphone to get information that I had to learn in advance a lot earlier. And so now it becomes a little bit more straightforward to do, but it's my job to give the dog directions and tell the dog step by step where I want it to go. And then it's the dog's job to make sure that when we're walking, that we do it safely. And that's why I always correct everyone, because the dog doesn't lead the blind person. It isn't like I have no brain and don't know what to do. People think that.
I hope it didn't sound like I was accusing you of that.
No, but, no. You didn't. But people tend to think if you're blind, you really can't do much. I mean, the doctors told my parents when they discovered I was blind at about 4 months of age, I should be put in a home because no blind child could ever grow up to amount to anything and be a contributing member in society. And unfortunately, we still see that today. And the unemployment rate among employable blind people is in the 50 to 60% range, not because blind people can't work, but because sighted people think blind people can't work. But the reality is we learn just like you do. We may use different techniques. And one of the things that I've evolved and talked about on Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast you mentioned earlier, is we need to change our definition of disability. Because disability does not mean a lack of ability. Now, all my diversity friends say, well, yes, it does, because it begins with dis. And my response to that is, well, if that's the case, then what about disciple, discern, discreet? They begin with D-I-S. Now, the bottom line is that disability doesn't mean a lack of ability. Disability is a characteristic that every person on this planet has. It manifests itself differently. For most of you, you're light dependent. But Thomas Edison invented the electric light bulb, and the electric light bulb became a way for you to get light on demand whenever you need it. But just watch the power fail, and suddenly you don't have light at night, or sometimes even during the day, and panic ensues. I was in a hotel last year at 3 in the afternoon when we lost power in the hotel, and people in the lobby freaked out. Even though there was lots of light coming in through the windows and so on, it wasn't coming from all the fixtures on the ceilings and so on, and people panicked. The bottom line is light dependence is a disability, but you cover it up because light on demand is so ubiquitous through all the ways that you have access to it, that you don't think that you have a disability. But just watch the power go out, and you certainly do.
Yeah. Well, I know we talked about the unemployment rate, at least one of our other conversations here on Talking Animals, and it's discouraging to hear that it's so low, because I would just like to think that with you, and again, you're unusually high profile, and a while back, you might know, we had Marion Guzdahl on the show.
Yeah,
and
I know.
And just various people that are super bright, super accomplished. Not that every other blind person is the same. Of course, it can't go the other direction too far. But you would think people would start to say, well, why can't they do this job? Or why should we rule this out without even calling the guy or the woman in for an interview? I mean, it just sounds like the bias is still so strong that there's sometimes not even possible opportunity for people who might be fantastic at whatever the job is.
But that's what we're taught, right? We're taught that eyesight is really the only game in town. That's what most people grow up to believe. And they don't ever get taught that there are other ways to do things. We don't tend to really think in a more innovative way. We're taught that you got to be able to see to do stuff. And as I'm sure Marion pointed out and others point out and I point out, the fact of the matter is blindness isn't the problem. It's our perceptions and our attitudes about blindness. And so, yes, I do, with the pandemic subsiding somewhat, I'm back out traveling and speaking. And so I'm always looking to travel and speak to corporations and so on to tell the World Trade Center story and other things. You know, and very frankly, if people go to michaelhingson.com, they can learn about that and they can contact me and we can talk about it. But bottom line is it's like, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. And it's all about taking every step. But we're a low incidence disability and we're just not that visible. So the conversation, even among so-called experts, tends to leave out disabilities. As I mentioned earlier, with diversity experts, they talk about diversity being involved with gender, sexual orientation, and race and so on, but they never, or very, very rarely, ever include disability, because when they talk about it, they say, oh, that's a social justice issue. Well, not according to the Center for Disease Control, that says that about 25% of all people in this country have some sort of a, well, I'm going to call it traditional disability, as opposed to what I would define as 100% of people have a disability. But the fact of the matter is disability is a very large minority compared to all the other things that we hear about in the typical diversity environment. And it's high time that we start to deal with it. I mean, my gosh, only about 3% of all websites are accessible. And I work with a company called Accessibee that helps make websites more inclusive. And it's got a number of different kinds of technologies that it uses to make that happen. But the bottom line is, still, we're dealing with only about 3% of all websites that are made to be inclusive. Even the government is very slow to do it. And there's no excuse for that other than we're not a priority.
Yeah, I guess it goes without saying. I just find that part itself you just mentioned about the websites, of course, but more broadly, just so discouraging that with, as you say, there's so much emphasis on diversity these days of all different kinds, that disability, people with blind and others, isn't part of that discussion as prominently as it should be. And just feels like there should be more inroads made by now. But I don't need to tell you that, I guess. Jeez.
Well, people like you help when you do shows like this, and you know, you might consider doing more shows or getting other people to do shows to talk about some of these stories and to get people to understand. It's not magic to make your website, for example, accessible and inclusive. There are processes to do it. There are guidelines to help make it happen. But most people, including a lot of website developers, know nothing about how to do it. It's not hard.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like that's a step that many of us could take without too much trouble and too much added cost, probably, to really help address the problem on a broader scale.
Well, it is. My wife, when she was alive, she passed away in November of 2022. We were married 40 years. One of the things we did was we watched a lot of shows on HGTV where different people built houses or modified houses and so on. And incredibly rarely did they ever deal with accessibility or inclusion in the houses that they built. And I'm not thinking so much of blindness, but for example, my wife in a wheelchair. She was in a chair her whole life. And these builders and these people who go in and fix up houses generally never think of, well, what about down the line? What can we do to make this house attractive and accessible right from the outset with what we're doing to make changes? And it happens. The people who come in and do assessments when you sell a house. When we sold our house in New Jersey and moved out to California, our house had an elevator in it, a $15,000 elevator, but the assessor said, that doesn't have anything to do with the value of the house. You know, that's the attitude. And it continues so much today.
Wow. Again, discouraging to say the least. Jeez.
Well, rather than being discouraged, it should really get people to decide that we're going to do something about it. We're going to help promote the conversation. We're going to help get people to understand that we're all on the same planet. So I would say rather than anybody being discouraged, this is an opportunity for people to think about it and to talk to other people about it and to learn about accessibility, like learning about guide dogs, that they don't lead blind people. It's a team effort, and both have jobs to do, and the team works best when both respect each other's job. But the reality is what we need to do is not be discouraged, but rather really work harder to promote the conversation across the board.
Yeah, get busy and do something or help spread the message, et cetera. Yeah. Let me let folks know who might have just tuned in. This is Talking Animals on WMF. I'm Duncan Stelzi. If you did just tune in, my guest is Michael Hingson, blind since birth, a long-time best-selling author and acclaimed speaker. On 9/11, as we mentioned earlier, Hingson was working in the North Tower, and famously, he and his guide dog and many others in the building ended up being down to the ground floor to safety. His resulting book immediately landed on the New York Times bestseller list. He's now published a new book, Live Like a Guide Dog, True Stories from a Blind Man and His Dogs About Being Brave, Overcoming Adversity, and Moving Forward in Faith. If you have questions for Michael or would like to offer a comment about guide dogs, about diversity, about any of the other things we've already touched on, or just dogs generally, or anything else that comes to mind, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So I guess getting back a little bit more to the book, did you have a so-called light bulb moment when you realized recounting the experiences with all eight dogs could serve as sort of the spine of what would sort of naturally, maybe comfortably support the storytelling and what kind of amounts to a memoir, basically?
I don't know that I would say I had a light bulb moment, but when we started thinking about it, it was just kind of a natural progression. And it became kind of what we decided to do. And of course, my world involves dogs in so many ways. It just seemed like the thing to do. And the fact is, I've talked a lot about the fact that I've learned more from all of my guide dogs than I ever learned from Tony Robbins, Ken Blanchard, and all those experts and those motivational experts and those management experts, because the dogs don't come to life with a hidden agenda. They don't come to life with much of an agenda. They live in the moment, and it's an extremely powerful lesson that we ought to learn, that maybe living more in the moment is a good thing to do. So rather than worrying about everything, as I said earlier, that we don't have control over, just focus on what we really have our own influence over, and don't worry about the rest, because it's not going to be something that we can control. Now, it doesn't mean you don't be aware of other stuff, but you don't need to worry about it. And you can teach yourself how not to fear all the things that you don't have control over. You know, I know when Donald Trump was elected president recently, people started talking about, I'm going to move out of the United States and all this sort of stuff like that. What good is that going to do you? And the reality is, like it or not, every 4 years we elect a president. And the fact is that more people voted for Donald Trump than voted for Kamala Harris or whatever. So he's the president. If he doesn't do well and address all the issues that he claims are things that we need to focus on, then that's a different story, and people should hold him accountable, because he claims he's going to make life better. Well, and he's defined what making life better is about. He's also talked about ways of doing it that I know a lot of people disagree with, but the bottom line is, if he makes life better, then there you go. But if he doesn't, then we deal with it. We can control that in 4 years. But until then, he's president.
Yeah. Well, that may bring us to an important part of the book. I'd like to discuss fear, which it is sort of a central part of the book. And again, very much including the concept that being afraid can serve as a virtue. So just talk to me about fear. You've kind of touched on it a little bit, and especially I think it was notable when you talked about dogs don't experience, you know, what if. So they don't get in their own way on that kind of fear just inherently. But talk to me about how guide dogs have influenced how you respond to fear.
Well, as I said earlier, observing dogs and seeing how they behave and spending the time to learn about how they behave and what they think about is extremely important. After September 11th, I called Guide Dogs for the Blind and talked to their veterinarians and asked what they thought about Roselle and how she behaved after September 11th, as I said, grabbing her favorite tugbone and immediately started playing tug-of-war. And the first question I was asked was, did anything really threaten her directly? Did anything harm her? And the answer was no. Nothing directly threatened her and nothing hurt her. And the vet said, there you go. Dogs don't do what ifs. Dogs focus on the moment. And when something is going on and when it's done, it's done. We don't behave that way, and it would be so much more effective in our lives if we did. So the fact is that if we learn to focus on our world in a positive way, we can learn how to use fear in a very constructive way to help us focus on what we need to deal with. I'm not going to say don't be afraid, but you do have control over how fear affects you. You do have control over saying, I'm not going to suddenly not be able to make decisions because I'm afraid. I'm going to use this to help me focus, analyze, learn what's going on, and move forward. And the more of that that we do, and the more we look at our own lives, the more we'll develop our mind muscle, if you will, to help us learn that, in fact, we can control that fear and move forward in a positive way. And how do we do that? Well, at the end of the day, it would be great if people would take a few minutes as they're slowly falling asleep and be introspective. What happened today? What was good? What wasn't good? Failure isn't something that we ought to continue to promote. If you don't have success with something, it isn't that you failed. The question really becomes, what could I have done to make whatever happened go better? What do I do the next time it happens? And if we really think about those things and allow our brains to analyze and help us get the solutions to those questions, and the more of it we do, the better we'll be able to focus in our world. Also, what went well today? Could I have done it even better? We should really spend time every day thinking about what we do, why we do it, how we do it, and if we were afraid of something, why we're afraid. Because mostly, we fear things that never come to pass anyway.
Well, also, too, from what I've read in your book and otherwise sort of gathered over the years that we've know each other. I mean, sometimes that sort of situational training is obviously pivotal, but sometimes it's earlier than that. Like your parents, your upbringing were seemingly distinctly devoted to cultivating confidence, sort of effectively preempting a great deal of fear from even developing. I'm thinking about not only encouraging you to ride a bike around your neighborhood and beyond, but defending your bicycle riding when some jerk, I guess, in the neighborhood or nearby called your dad to complain. But I'm also thinking about when you were a kid about to attend a new school and your mom took you to the campus several times before school started so you could map out the locations of your classrooms, where you'd eat lunch and so on. So again, mitigating the kind of fear that very reasonably you would have. I mean, any kid starting a new school often has a fear, but yours obviously had a different element to it. And that was minimized by those kind of trips that you took with your mom. And I think that made a big difference going forward.
Well, sure, because I don't get to read signs like other people do. So it's important for me to learn the information in another way. And I would also point out to everyone who can see, if you just rely on reading signs and you don't really learn and know things, that's a problem. Because what happens if suddenly you can't read the sign? So like you're in a room, and I've asked many audiences about this. We're sitting in a room, and I'm giving a talk, and I ask people, do you know where all the emergency exits are in the room? Did you know, for example, there's one behind the stage over here? It's behind a curtain, so you won't necessarily see it. But people should learn rather than just reading signs, because the time may come when you can't see that sign. Knowledge is the powerful thing, not just assuming that you've got it all when you don't necessarily have it. So knowledge is what really need to become more effective at gaining. And when I ask people about that emergency exit, the reality is most rooms that are any kind of a size at all have some exits behind the stage because celebrities who are there need to be able to get out and so on. We all should know about those sorts of things, at least that they exist.
Yeah, well, I mentioned mapping your school, but I sort of got to thinking after reading a book about how much of your life has involved, you know, mapping in a slightly different sense, so you could easily find your way around new neighborhoods or commute by subway when you're living in and around New York, or you frequently relocated for job opportunities. So, I mean, some of that is training, but you clearly have a gift in mind for such mapping because you're not coincidentally, you have a master's in physics. So I think you just kind of have that mind that's bent in that direction. Well, but then you've taken the steps to really cultivate that as well.
One of the most important things I learned in getting a master's degree in physics professors talk about it a lot, is pay attention to the details. If, for example, it isn't enough to get the right numeric answer if the units don't match. Paying attention to details is a very important thing. And the more of it you do, and the more you teach yourself to do it, the better you will be, and the more effective you'll be the next time you want to go off and pay attention to details. It's something that you have to develop, and you have to want to develop it, But if you do, you'll be more effective and you'll be more knowledgeable. And I think that's really the thing that we have to deal with. We've got to focus on details. We've got to learn to do it. And we've got to learn to develop those maps, that knowledge, and develop the skills to gain that knowledge and those maps and so on that you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, and with that comes confidence. And then that helps keep kind of fears that could otherwise rear their ugly heads at bay.
Well, and also that gets conveyed to, for me, my guide dogs. Because if I'm confident and I'm focused and I'm encouraging the dog and not panicking, and I've gotten lost, and there are a couple of examples of that in Live Like a Guide Dog where I got lost at doing something. One of the things that the best agencies for the blind in the country teach, the agencies like the agencies associated with the National Federation of the Blind, like the Colorado Center for the Blind and the Louisiana Center for the Blind, the reality is they teach something that's called structured discovery. If you suddenly are walking along and you decide or you realize you're lost, the best thing to do is to stop and retrace your steps mentally and figure out where you went wrong. And the fact is you can do that. And you can discover what you did that really took you down the wrong path. We don't do enough of that collectively in society. But the fact is that structured discovery is a very powerful tool that we all ought to be able to use. Now, of course, I'm not saying don't read signs, but I'm saying go beyond reading signs and really learn and know. And it will make your life a whole lot better and a whole lot less fearful.
Again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Stress. My guest is Michael Hingson, best-selling author, whose new book is Live Like a Guide Dog, True Stories from a Blind Man and His Dogs About Being Brave, Overcoming Adversity, and Moving Forward in Faith. You're invited to join this conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So in the new book, your faith, your relationship with God seems far more prominent than in your previous book or in our previous conversations. And you indicate also in the book that faith was important to the family in your formative years and obviously beyond. But it seems to play a much larger role as you present the sort of ongoing accounts that constitute Live Like a Guide Dog. Is that just because it's become more important to you, or you just feel more comfortable talking about it maybe than in the past? Or
I think probably it's evolving and becoming better. I think the issue with most people, when you talk to people and they say, well, we pray to God, we tell God what we want. And, you know, the bottom line is God knows what you want. You don't have to tell God. The issue, and I've had several examples where I've heard pastors and so on talk about this. What we really need to do is to learn how to listen. And we need to have the confidence and faith that God will guide us. And the reality is that whether people like it or not, there is, I believe, a force that governs all of us, and call it God or whatever. But the bottom line is that we can learn how to listen to that and how to gain the things that we need from listening. We don't need to tell God or whoever what we need, because if they're really omnipotent and omnipotent and omniscient, they know. And we should really restructure a lot of our thinking around God to understand that God's talking with us if we want to listen. And I talked about that in Thunderdog when we were running away from Tower 2, and the first thing I thought of was the towers were collapsing and I was running back the way I came. I said, God, I can't believe you got us out of a building just to have it fall on us. And what I heard in my head as clearly as you're hearing me speak now is, don't worry about what you can't control. Focus on running with Roselle and the rest will take care of itself. And I had this immediate sense and certainty that if we worked together, we'd be fine. And that was what happened. But it was a matter of listening because we don't do enough of that. We think that we control everything. And again, that gets back to what I said earlier. We should worry about what we really have control over and forget the other things, or at least don't let them help us become more fearful.
Yeah, so but would you say that faith always played as significant a role as it comes across in the new book, or as you've reassessed for the book, did some things take on, you know, larger prominence?
No, faith has always been a part of my life, and I think that that talking about it more in the ways that I do hopefully won't put off people who say, well, I don't know that God can do all that stuff and all that. I don't know whether I believe in God. Well, the bottom line is it's a mental state. And the fact of the matter is that I choose to believe that there are things in this universe that can help us if we are open to it. And the fact of the matter is that clearly my life is a good example of that.
Okay. Yeah, no, I was much more struck by the faith and the conversations with God than, again, in the previous book or just some of the conversations we've had on the radio show here. So I just wasn't sure if there had been a shift in some way or just was represented more prominently book.
It just seemed like it was more relevant to talk about that a lot more in this particular book. And it is appropriate to do it because it's a part of my life and it's a part of the way I operate.
For sure.
You know, and so many things have happened. As I mentioned, my wife passed in November of 2022. She became ill in July. So in reality, as I've told people, I was given 5 months or 4 months to prepare, and we hoped that it wouldn't happen. But when it did, and Karen passed after 40 years of marriage, I was able to continue to move forward. I never will say I move on from Karen. I don't, because Karen's always been a part of and always will be a part of my life. I do move forward, though, but I've got 40 years of memories that I get to treasure and keep to help me continue to move forward and speak and talk about a variety of different things. And so now it's me, Alamo, and Stitch, our rescue feline, who live here in the house. And other people who do come in and help with correspondences and other kinds of things. But really, the three of us live here, and I've learned to cook in my life, and so I still grill and do other kinds of things and prepare meals. It's still fun doing it for one person, really, so I don't tend to make things as complicated as we used to when we were both here. But by the same token, it's all about recognizing that life is an adventure, and we have the opportunity to live it, and life as an adventure becomes what we make of it.
Yeah. Well, I'm very sorry about your loss, and the book kind of hints that that's where this is headed, but wasn't really clear until the latter part, and I'm very sorry about that, and that was a lot of years with her, and obviously...
Yeah.
Great relationship. And sounds like you've got various animals there. And that's one of the things, too, I guess I was struck by is that besides whatever guide dog was, on duty, there seemed like there was other animals, including other dogs, in the household at times. Just, again, further reflecting on what we've already touched on before is that, you know, you truly love dogs and love animals. So... the kind of treatment that a guide dog gets or a retired guide dog gets is pretty supreme.
Well, I value them. I value what they bring to my life and what I get to bring to their life. And as I said, people who have dogs who are their pets, the fact is dogs want to know what we want from them. They generally do expect that we're the pack leaders. And excuse me, all they really want us to do is to tell them the rules in a positive way and to tell them what we expect and to hold them to that, and they'll do it. I've had so many people tell me, oh, my dog could never be a guide dog because it runs around the house and when I leave it tears things up and so on or whatever. Well, that makes me ask the question, what rules did you set? How did you deal with the dog? How did you teach it to be a home alone if you have to leave during the day and don't take the dog? And I've left Alamo home sometimes, but generally I take him wherever I go. The cat doesn't go with me wherever I go, and she's much happier being in the house.
But
the fact is we've set the rules, and we're consistent, and consistency is one of the most important things that I think dogs and even cats like and expect from us. And if we're consistent, And if we're setting the rules and being reasonable about it and rewarding them when they do what we want in a positive way, if we reward them in a positive way, it's so much more important than yelling at them or whatever. You don't hit dogs. You don't yell at them. What you do is you reward the positive behavior. Yeah. Guide Dogs for the Blind back in the early 2000s started using clickers in their training techniques. apparently, clickers, that little cricket that you can carry in your pocket and you click it and the dog, what you use that clicker for is to demark and denote something that they did that you like. And then if you click with the clicker and then immediately give them a food reward, they know that the clicker means good job. And it has actually dramatically decreased the amount of time it takes to train a guide dog when clickers are used.
Yeah.
One of the first things when I got Alamo, we were up in Oregon. I went to the Oregon campus of Guide Dogs for the Blind. And as we were walking down a sidewalk, we came to an alleyway. So there was no curb down or anything like that. But what the trainer did was he said, watch this. And when we got to the alleyway, she said, tell the dog to halt. I did. And she clicked. This was like the first day. So she was still very much in charge of doing things like that. And within about two or three times of doing that, she, Alamo, stopped every time he came to that alleyway. And I bet that if I go to Oregon right now, some 7 years later, he would still remember and stop at that alleyway because she clicked, he got a food reward from me, and he knew that that was the right thing to do. So there are very constructive, positive ways that we can tell these animals what we expect and give them positive reinforcement when they do it right.
Yeah. Good old operant conditioning, I guess, to some extent.
It is. Yeah. It's better than all the negative reinforcements.
For sure. So we're nearing the end of our time, Michael, but I think I have a hunch here, but if you had to say, which of the eight dogs did you learn the most from, or which one influenced you the most, whichever way you want to answer it?
Oh, gosh. That is so hard to do. I mean, there are so many things that Roselle did. What I've done most times when I get a new guide dog and the trainers, when they're doing all their initial screenings, say, what do you want in a dog? I always say, I want a dog with an on and off switch. I want a dog that knows when the harness is on, it's time to work. When the harness comes off, then they can play. And so I ask for that. I also insist that dogs have to like cats because we've generally had cats over the 40 years that Karen and I have been married. And so I don't want a dog that is going to have any problem with a cat. But the biggest issue is the on and off switch. So Roselle did it really well. She's not the only dog that did it. My fourth guide dog, Linny, was extremely bright in a lot of ways and probably the most empathetic of all of my eight guide dogs. If we went to a party, and some people observed this to me, and I let Linny just loose to wander and visit with people, as a pastor friend of mine once said, she always went to the person who was in the most pain first, that is emotionally, and then she visited everybody else. And she did that in ways I've never seen other dogs do. So, you know, each dog has provided things to me that I treasure and value and remember. But, of course, there's no way to not single out Roselle for what she did on September 11th.
Yeah.
I think a number of my dogs could have done that, but Roselle did it so well.
Yeah, for sure. So the email just came in. It's far too long to read all of it, but let me read a portion of it just because there might be some things you'd like to respond to that fit into our conversation here. Since for the speaker, you mentioned that your retired guide dog still lives with you, which I hope is what usually happens when the dogs retire. Are there any lessons people can learn from guide dogs about retirement or coping with change in our roles and home situations? How quickly does the retired dog understand that they are retired now, but there is still a place for them in the home? Is it a smooth process for them to trust the newbie guide dog with their person's welfare, and there's a quote-unquote a new sheriff in town? How do they make sure they still feel needed? I think this could help people deal with change, including job changes and retirement.
So let me talk about my seventh guide dog, Africa. I got Africa in 2008, and Africa worked until the 9th of February in 2018. In 2017, I noticed that Africa was starting to slow down, and she also didn't see as well at night. So those are two indicators that it's probably time to start thinking about retiring her. So we had a year to prepare, in a sense, because the lead time to get a new guide dog was pretty long at that time. And so what I did was I contacted guide dogs, and we agreed that we should work toward that. And so I went through the process. But I also started using Africa a little bit less, and I let her stay home, and I tied her down, and you know, or put her in a crate, and she was fine with that. So again, it just seemed like it was the kind of thing that said, it's time to retire. But I'm the team leader. I have to make that decision for us, and so I can't just let the dog continue to work. These dogs will work till they drop. They are so committed to doing what they do, and they want to please. So it's my job to really deal with that. And so I knew that I had to be the one to say it's time to retire. So I started using Africa a little bit less. And she didn't react too negatively to that. At first, she was a little bit pushy about wanting to be in the harness. I said, no, stay here. It's okay. And I just used a cane and walked around. But by the 9th of February, and that was the day she retired, we had also made the decision that we would let her puppy raisers take her, because Karen had her service dog, Fantasia, who was actually Africa's mother. I was going to then go get a new guide dog. And Karen had developed some rheumatoid arthritis and, of course, was in a wheelchair. So we knew she wasn't going to be able to handle two dogs. So her Africa's puppy raisers, the people who raised her from about 3 months to about 18 months, lived not too far from us. And they drove up, and they took Africa on the 9th of February. Africa went out the door without a backward glance. She was fine.
Yeah.
But it was a matter of preparing. And so that is something that we all can do in again, whatever we do. When people are going to retire from a job, think about it. Plan for it. Prepare your mind that you're going to be doing something different. There's nothing wrong with the whole concept of retiring.
Yeah.
And there's also nothing wrong with continuing to work. It's what you decide to do.
Right. Well, I think we might have to leave it there, Michael, because we're sort of way over time at this point. But so great conversation. This has been Michael Hinkson. His new book is Live Like a Guide Dog, True Stories from a Blind Man and His Dogs About Being Brave, Overcoming Adversity, and Moving Forward in Faith. His website is Michael.
Wherever books are sold.
Yeah, and his website is Michael Hinkson. It's for HINGSON.com, MichaelHinkson.com. So, Michael, thanks again for joining us on Talking Animals, and good luck with the book, and take care.
Well, thank you. Let's do it again.
You bet. Right now, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with Paul F. Tompkins, the comedian and actor whose many credits include Mr. Show with Bob and David, with a piece offering a different perspective maybe on dogs. I'll apologize for your dog in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
The scariest thing I've experienced lately is dogs. I never used to be afraid of dogs. And then I lived in this building, this apartment building, that made me scared of all dogs now forever. Because it was like weird immersion therapy. It was like I was supposed to be scared of dogs, and I wasn't. And somebody wanted to get me there. Like, no, 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 you're supposed to be scared of dogs. I know what to do. I'll put you in this crazy-ass building where everybody has an insane, vicious dog but you. That's what it was like. Everybody in this building, it was like I missed a memo in the common area or something where... It's like, let's all get crazy dogs. If you don't want to get one, check this box. And then I never saw that memo. Every day this happened, every day, I would be walking down the stairs from my apartment, and just as I was kind of like, you know, thinking, what is today going to hold for me? I would like turn the corner on the landing, and then, dog out of nowhere, barking, so angry at me. Why is he so mad at me? So mad. And it's like, well, what happened was I would, of course, jump, you know, and then I'll be perfectly honest with you. Sometimes I would make a noise of some sort. Like I would jump and go, ah! like that. What drove me crazy was the person whose dog it is, the person standing there on the other end of this leash, right? They would not apologize for the dog for what just happened. Like, they saw it happen. It's not like it was subtle, right? It's not like they were looking away like, oh, what's happening? Are you guys talking? We're not talking. This dog wants to have my face in his mouth. Never, never an apology. And it's not like I didn't give them the in for the apology either. I mean, I tossed them some nice fat softballs. You know what I'm saying? I made it easy. Just something like, wow. He certainly gave me quite a start, that dog that is your responsibility. Man, oh man. Whew, trying to catch my breath here. Oh, really scared me there. Me, a fellow human being with feelings and dignity. Whew, it's like I saw my life flash before my eyes. Oh, man. I was so scared. I mean, I'm sure that the dog would apologize if he could, but as he... as he lacks the capacity for speech, I wonder who will pick up the baton.
All right, that's Paul F. Tompkins here on Talk Animals in the Comedy Corner. Peace called. Apologize for your dog. Nearing the end of our edition of Talk Animals here. Coming up, it's the conversation of the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. And our guest today will be Becky Yita. She's a media director, producer, and entrepreneur, and is the creative consultant for Tampa Bay Community Network. Her story is one of determination and resilience. That'll be coming up momentarily here, right after the NPR News headlines on Talking Animals, on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday with another edition of Talking Animals. And in the meantime, you can find all our shows at talkinganimals.net, links to our social media pages, etc. We'll see you next week on Talking Animals here on 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa. Thanks again for listening. Stay tuned for the conversation.